Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What's good, internet? It is August 25th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 91.
Yeah.
Joining me, that was the voice of Danielle Riendo.
So the old Danielle's not answering the phone.
Okay.
Because she's dead.
Okay. We seem to have Danielle Swift here. D-Swizzy.
D-Swizzle, baby.
Uh-huh.
Old Danielle's dead.
Fuck, that song's bad.
It is.
So
okay, hold on.
All right, Patrick Klepek also joining us.
Yeah.
Also a Taylor Swift fan?
I am a...
Historically?
Pop music aficionado. I have a deep adoration for both 1989 and Red specifically out of the Taylor Swift catalog. I really like pop music as a form and...
Right.
As an art.
There was a time when I would have really judged you for that, and I'm so fucking glad I'm out of that time. Like, the, 16 to 23-year-old Austin was the fucking worst.
Ugh.
Look, so. I still sit and listen to Sigur Rós with their made-up Icelandic language, and then on the other end, I really enjoy, blasting, a song like Take It Off, Shake It Off. Take It Off, no, that's a...
Whoa!
Hey.
Sorry.
Be careful, you're gonna wind up in a fucking Taylor Swift song.
That's new Taylor, not old Taylor who's dead. So just so you know.
You're the you she's talking about, and look what you made me do.
Oh my God.
Rob Zachney also here with us.
I'm just happy to be here.
That's good. Oh my God.
It's bad.
Patrick.
This single, I come at the single not to drag it because it's a popular thing to drag today.
Right.
It's just to say, Taylor Swift, popular, mostly beloved pop figure, has made something that critically is being rejected.
Hold
She's
on.
She's going through a bit of, what's the reverse of a renaissance?
A rut?
Not just a rut, because a rut suggests, professional...
Oh, you're just doing the same thing.
Right.
She's going through a collapse of the Roman Empire?
Right. I think she's going through a bit of a backlash, but it's a long backlash. It's been a year of backlash, and
both Katy Perry, terrible pop album. Her new album is a complete fucking disaster. Pseudo political bullshit single nonsense. And I'm fine with politics in your
pop music,
but it's
right.
But that single was bad. The album is bad. They tried to do a Space Jam music video for some shitty song called Swish Swish recently, and it's bad. It's bad all around.
Mm-hmm.
And I have deep reverence for Space Jam 2, so you're coming at a lot of my things.
Wait,
Katy
you have
Perry.
Deep reverence for Space Jam 2? You've seen Space Jam 2? You've already seen the sequel?
I can't talk about that.
Mark Laidlaw put
he
it on
wrote
his
it.
Blog.
Oh wow.
Good.
That's, I feel like we probably should just end the podcast.
Yeah.
That's it. That's
Thank you, Rob.
Oh my God.
So the thing I
Mugs
do want
running. Right, of course. All right.
I am a distant observer of the ongoing drama of Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
But I am curious. There's an element of this. The song is really mediocre. But then there's also an element of the song is an attempt at the artist presenting herself as one thing. And it does kind of feel like just collectively, people have had enough of Taylor's shit.
Yeah.
And
this specific bit doesn't work any. You're so popular. You're so popular. You can't just keep playing the victim. Weirdly, this is the same shit that got Kanye in trouble years ago, right? Which is my dude, you helped define a new generation of music. You don't get to whine anymore, which is not fair. Everyone gets to whine.
Right.
But the sort of positioning yourself as vulnerable, not just vulnerable, but as someone who's not in a position of power, is one, like, really not a good look. And then two, and I think there's a lot of the pressure on Taylor right now, is just like, you have a position of power and you've fucking done nothing with it for the last year, a year in which people with positions of power should have thought about, what can I do with my platform? How can I reach people? How can I make the world slightly better? Especially given what people believe to be her politics, her family's politics, you know, the fact that she's kind of been like whitefeminism.txt for the last 3 years, right? Like, has been just like, oh, like, big brand feminism, like, girl power, buy my album. Like, right. that's what it is to
that's
be
her thing.
To be a woman in the mid, you know, 2010s is gotta support T-Swift, girl power, hashtag squad, right? Like,
but also, hold on. You would be able to rise above all of that criticism if the song was
right
good,
it was good.
Right? So it's like, well, the political criticism, like, would exist, but it would exist in a series of takes on Vulture and other places across the internet. But you could get over that if it was a song. I mean, you're never going to recreate Shake It Off. That is like a defining pop song of like the last 10 years. Like, you're not going to quite reach that height again.
Until Take It Off. Yeah.
Of exactly.
Until Take It Off. The sequel song.
But it's just not good. Like, it's not catchy. It's not interesting. I'll give it a couple other listens. But like, I think she's getting it from both sides, because it is both does not engage with what people were hoping Taylor Swift would do as sort of like a political platform, and then also is unable to deflect that criticism by just being like a incredibly good peeps of pop music,
right,
which then can use that as a shield against the criticism, because people can go, well, yeah, like, that part sucks, but like, yo, that song is like really good.
Really good, yeah. Which again is the thing that like the Kanyes of the world will do, is like, be shitty, be like, you know, completely insufferable, and then like, I can't stop listening to this fucking album.
I know.
God damn it.
Yep.
And like, but that's what Taylor Swift has done for me in the past too. That's what a lot of like pop musicians have done for me in the past. She's like, oh, I really hate everything about your public persona, everything about what your lyrics are. But this is just in my brain, and I'm never it's never getting out of my brain.
Can I ask a really intense question here at this?
Yes,
please.
Are you talking about Justin Bieber?
I'm not actually. Well, okay. That track that's like huge. Right? What's that? What's the summer? What's the song?
That's
the
not even his song, though.
It's not. That's,
yeah, it's a Bieber feature.
It's a Bieber feature. Whose song is that? Is that a?
God.
I don't know the group.
This is bad.
Which is probably
is
most people. Most people probably don't know that. What the group's name is?
Yeah. Fuck. I can't believe I don't. I can't think of the song.
I'm mixed.
Well, is it a group or is it a label songwriter?
It's a.
No, he jumped on like a Hispanic like. Pop track.
It's on the
Despacito.
One. No, not Despacito is. Oh, right. He was also on Despacito. Right.
He's on
the one I was thinking of. Yeah, he does the remix of that, and the video for that is hilarious and bad. But the one I was thinking of was the DJ Khaled "I'm the One," which is Beat
the
Chance.
Sure.
Right.
And Lil Wayne,
like, that song's really catchy.
That song is super catchy.
It's so catchy.
Chance's verse is really good. Anyway.
Yeah.
Has Taylor thought about doing more tracks with people who are better musicians than she is? I'm just saying.
No.
Maybe the old her that's dead was the one who was a good musician.
Oh.
I think the odds of her being able to do those collaborations were somewhat dinged by the release of that phone call.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
Like, probably at that point, it's like, I don't know if I want to collaborate.
Yeah, I mean, probably not going to get Kendrick on anything anymore.
Yeah.
At this point. Anyway, welcome to Waypoint Radio, our weekly culture and music podcast.
All of this means is that the imminent rise and ascendancy of the true pop queen, Carly Rae Jepsen, whose album Emotion is one of the best pop albums of the last 10 years. And if you judge her based on songs like Call Me Maybe, you are depriving yourself of some of the best 80s influenced like pop album. Emotion is incredible. The B-sides, it's very, very good. And you should go listen to it. Call Me Maybe and I Really, Really Like You are not representative of her great work. Carly Rae, ascend the throne.
Made that tweet the other day, Patrick. Patrick made a tweet that was just like, Carly Rae Jepsen was robbed, basically, of the fame that she should have had. And I was like, that's not true. Like, that album did really well. And then I looked and, like, it barely sold over 100,000 copies. Like, it only sold 12,000 copies, like, in its first week or 16,000. That's, like, really low. That's really low. I know 16,000
people.
It's
like the prey of pop albums.
Right. It's the prey of
you
pop
have
albums.
Way more. Oh, no. Oh, I just got really sad. That's really, oh, my God.
Yeah, but But the second half of Emotion is really good.
Oh my God! Knives Jeez. Out right
I
now.
Am,
we coming for you, Craig. We coming for you, T Swift.
I'm flipping my mic.
Who's next?
I am out.
I've never liked Half-Life all that much. I'm just gonna say it. That
you know
game's
what?
All right.
Dark Souls games are overrated.
Okay.
Bloodborne
okay.
is the best by far. All right.
I went for. Right. I would agree with that, though. I don't think that's a hot
Road
take.
Road Total War fucking sucks.
Oh, my God. How about that Trump guy? We all,
yeah, we all hate him.
He's
we
no
all
good.
Hate him.
That's what I'm going to
yeah.
hot take.
Yeah, that was like the, somebody advised it. There's Eve Fensler who like wrote a thing like, I don't know, guys. I think this Trump fella's no good.
No good.
Like, she kept writing it's, these, like, 50s old very, man, like, takes yeah. on Trump. Like, I think he's a bad fella.
It's very good. Vice.com for all your hottest. Half-Life. Let's talk about Half-Life briefly.
It's a good, there you go.
Okay, so I've never been a huge Half-Life fan. I beat the first Half-Life. I played a little bit of Half-Life 2, and it never did anything for me.
Did you play
like,
it at
did
the,
you play
yeah,
it
I was going to say.
Years later.
Yeah, I played it, I know, I played it when it hit the Orange Box collection, because
right.
I didn't have a gaming PC.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And I couldn't get past the boat section because I was bored to death of it.
I didn't even get that far, to be honest with you.
And
yeah.
and I, but I've since watched people play through the whole thing. I was like, I have to fucking watch a Let's Play of this or something. So I've done that, and you know, I respect it. I recognize what it did for games. I recognize like here are the keystones, you know, that it put in place for physics based simulation. Here's like some of the
some
really
storytelling
cool storytelling stuff,
yeah.
right? Totally. But it's never had, I just have no, even though I played through Half-Life 1 when it came out on a PC at the time, like, I just don't have any reverence. I don't have that, like, in my veins. But I have had, like, a deep professional curiosity, I think, like, most games journalists have, of like, all right, when are we going to get that Half-Life 3 news? Like, when is, how many of the rumors have that I've heard have been true? Like, how many Half-Life 3s have been shut down at Valve? Like, bit by bit, you see writer after writer after writer leave Valve. You see, like, people who would be on that team step away to go do other projects. Or you hear rumors, which are not verified, allegedly, you'll hear, like, oh, yeah, Valve just keeps paying these writers to basically sit in a room and just kind of, like, not go make games elsewhere.
Make some Team Fortress 2 comics.
Yes, exactly. And that's that has been, like, what we've heard for years. And then, in the middle of the night, last night, I got sent a link, and I clicked on it, and it didn't work because everyone was going to that link and had broken Mark Laidlaw's blog servers. Mark Laidlaw had previously been at Valve, had been a writer on the Half-Life projects.
He was the chief
was, like,
architect
the chief,
of
yeah.
the writing for... I mean, obviously, there are other people involved that came yep. in as the series evolved, but if you're like looking for like the genesis of like the Half-Life story structure, like yeah. you're thinking of Mark Laidlaw.
And he put out something called Epistle 3, which is a little joke because the last Half-Life game that came out was Half-Life 2 Episode 2, and it was supposed to be part of a 3-episode trilogy that was never finished. And it was like a names change to protect the innocent, like, overview about what Half-Life 2 Episode 3 would have been. It has since been, like, quote-unquote translated. You can go find it on NeoGAF. You can find, it's floating around
yeah.
Twitter and Facebook and stuff at this point. And it's like, oh, here's what the plan for Episode 3 would have been. And he said, like, oh, this is not official. This isn't it. No, it's not official. I have my doubts.
It's official.
It's not, you know, it doesn't have the Valve
well,
stamp
or official at one point, right?
Right.
Like,
this
I,
was
right.
in the writer's
this
room.
This was, right.
Yes.
That's the way. This reflects a thing that would have been that project at some point.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Patrick?
I think Rob and I maybe are on a different page. We're like, I was
totally.
In context with those series as they came out and mm-hmm. were revelatory for all the reasons that they are revered for, but also may make them harder to appreciate if you're playing them out of context of when mm-hmm. they were created. And so, like, I got to experience like the idea of like a story structure in a first-person shooter, which Half-Life. You know, more or less pioneered the modern approach to, and I got to experience like what it meant to have sort of like context clues for solving puzzles and the
right,
physics stuff that Half-Life
right.
did too. Like that was all like breaking things at the time and are can be appreciated, but I can also see how they kind of stick out in weird ways now or be more difficult to enjoy in a modern context. And like to like as a fan, like I'm not as deep into the Half-Life lore as some people are, but I deeply sympathize with the fan sort of ire over the idea of a trilogy being proposed, and not just the fact that it hasn't been finished. The thing that has always raised my ire with Valve has been their inability to provide closure in any right. measure of the word. If at some point Valve, like, it would have been better for Valve to say, we have decided to take our studio in a different direction. We have no intention of following up the Half-Life franchise that was, we were in a different place. Steam is the thing we do now. Dota is the thing we do now. And then if they ever decided to revisit Half-Life and finish it, it would be a genuine surprise and right. people's expectations would be in a better place. But, like, the fact that they've gone this long where, like, a couple of years ago, there was a Valve interview with Jeff Keighley where they cryptically, in code words, talked about the state of Half-Life 3 as a way of giving fans a game. This was a Gabe Newell interview, like, as a way of, like to people that are in the know, you'll know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think they talked about it in the context of, like, Ricochet 3, which is a reference to an early Valve like game that sometimes
yeah.
their first game, I think, or something like that. You can still buy it on Steam, and like
that game's all right.
Sure, but and that's the way they talk about this series, and I've always found it deeply frustrating because at some point, just like man the fuck up and explain what you're doing, because like you wouldn't be here without Half-Life. Like Half-Life right. defined right. your studio, the fans that built you up as a studio, like. Is on the back of Half-Life, and like
Source as an engine.
Yeah,
so much of that stuff comes back to Half-Life. And even though I don't have that emotional touchstone, I recognize it as like a kind of a shitty thing. Like I don't know.
There's also an element of like the way they've handled this. In addition to sort of having Half-Life end practically mid-sentence, like episode 2, like, is a hard fade to black.
it's a crazy cliffhanger.
Yeah. Yeah. It's ridiculous cliffhanger. I rewatched it last night because I was like, is that how it really? Yeah,
yep.
That's how it really ended.
It.
And guess what? The end of what episode 3 would have also been a ridiculous cliffhanger.
Yes.
So
yep. It would have been teasing Half-Life.
Or this Half-Life episode 3, whatever it would have been called, this version of it that Laidlaw lays out in this blog post, is unbelievable.
The other element of this, though, is that, like, I sort of have two problems with this. One is that there's no reason not for Valve to have not done anything with this. Like, Valve make the kind of money that they could, like, release a AAA bomb every year and it would not make a damn bit of difference to their bottom line. And they collected.
Right.
They collected really, like, top-tier game development and writing talent and put them in this, like, gilded cage and then, like, did nothing with it. It's this weird, like, You imagine yourself as, like, if I had those resources,
right.
I would try to make something happen.
So the stories that I've heard again and again were that they were trying to make things happen on different, you know, in completely different styles. They did, you know, stuff in VR. They wanted to do stuff around new ideas. Like, they needed something that was going to be as genre-defining as what the original Half-Life and what Half-Life 2 did. And or they didn't need to, but they set that goal internally. Right. Again, rumors from developers,
I've heard similar things over the years, and I think that was like that was the mistake they made.
Yes.
At some point they should have abandoned that as a standard, and even if it was a comic, like if they had put out an animated, like, Blizzard style, like, video that, like, just adapted what Laidlaw published as a way of saying, like, look, like, our standards to make a game are to make a game that is going to defy your expectations, but we understand fans want closure on the story. And even though the story that Laidlaw puts out ends with a cliffhanger that would have, like, led into a possible other, like, big-budget Half-Life game that was expansive as a Half-Life or Half-Life 2, there is enough closure there that, like, the story of Gordon Freeman is put in a place where the speculation you have about what happens next is different than the speculation that Half-Life Episode 2 ends with in a way that is far less frustrating to fans. And the fact that it's come out in a blog post, I think, is the most severe sort of indictment of how Valve has handled this. Like, it's 2017, the conclusion of the saga of the Half-Life 2 episodic trilogy was a fucking like cryptic blog post that has to be translated by hardcore fans.
I didn't even get to see it on the blog post because it was down. I read it in a paste bin file.
Yeah, perfect.
Like that's where I read the end of Half-Life. Nice, cool. I think it's also important, Patrick. A thing you just did briefly. We'll go to Rob in a second. You just did a Blizzard style cinematic, which is like a year ago we would have said a Valve style Team Fortress 2 style cinematic. And in that year, like lunch has been eaten.
Yep.
Rob, what were you going to say?
No, but the other aspect of this is that because like as long as Valve were doing a lot of these like cool creative things and there was the hope of a Half-Life 3, they could seem like something other than just a massive distribution monopoly. this idea that like Valve was also this like really lavishly funded treehouse where somewhere in the heart of that company, you know, the magic was happening.
Right, the masters were at leisure. Sort of... They were just like experimenting and like they were the most brilliant minds in game development working on something that would change the world again. And like...
Or at least be pretty cool.
Right, or at least be a pretty cool 8-hour game.
Yes.
Yeah, but so, and as I long
think,
as you wait, can...
Let's also just say briefly, I do think that like things like Portal and Portal 2 helped to ease the fear that we were never going to get a Half-Life Episode 2.
They put out good games, at least in the first part of this decade. Well, I guess
it's
the
been a
first
decade.
Year of the decade. Like, it came out in 2011, right, Portal 2?
Portal 2 was 2011.
Okay.
Half-Life 2 Episode 2 was 2007. Was October 10th, 2007. I don't know.
Jesus.
Who even knows at this point?
Yeah, but... So as long as you could sort of like kid your 2009.
Jesus Christ.
Dude.
So I mean, as long as you could pretend this was still a company that made cool stuff in addition to controlling the primary distribution platform for PC gaming, you could sort of pretend that it was something other than what it evidently is, right? And at this point, you know, you got Laidlaw basically being like, well, look, here's what we're working on. I give up. I'm done.
Leave me alone.
Here's
the
a
only
pace
thing
bin.
That the only thing that Valve's actively like developing is Dota, which is something you had like
not know. True. Artifact. Card game based on Dota 2.
Yeah.
The sequel to Defense of the Ancients.
Wow.
Right.
Which is a different game. Legally speaking.
And then you got and why are they investing in that stuff? Why are they developing it? Because it like fits their current business model. And Will Parton had a smart take on what Artifact is. It's going to be an actual trading card game where you have to conduct every single transaction
through the
goddamn Steam store.
Jesus Christ.
So I hope I can play it in the Steam store. I hope I can just go into my inventory and move stuff around, and that's how
that's
play.
That's the game.
That's the game.
That is the game.
Hell yeah!
Oh no, sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. So I mean, just where I'm going to leave off with this is like. Valve like became in the business of just like utilizing the hell out of this channel they built, and the thing that I'd always sort of had this worry about was like was Half-Life 2 really just a Trojan horse to get this goddamn distribution channel into every like PC gamer's house? And
you want to know their intention? Like, is that really where we're at? The like,
I think it's
theorizing. Yeah,
I think it's worth being. I'm not that cynical to think that was part of the intention back then. But I think the result was a means to an end that you can now be cynical about going forward, right? Like, so I don't think they funded and created Half-Life 2 thinking like, yes, this is the way we Trojan horse Steam. And I mean, Steam sucked at first. Like, Steam was when you bought Half-Life 2 on Steam, it was a pile of shit, and you were wondering why
Steam
you bought into this
for
in the
like
first place.
A month. You know, that's the thing. Like, yeah, Steam had a rough launch when it, like, was actually created, but, like, wasn't long after that.
Sure, totally.
It started to really take off. Like, at a certain point, once Steam was up and running and became, like, was the primary revenue stream for that company, I just find it kind of disappointing how quickly they... started to back away from developing their own ideas.
Yes.
And then increasingly back away from developing any ideas at all.
I really want to play a compilation of every prototype, of every half-finished, half-baked fucking idea that they had for Half-Life 3. Because you know there's 100 of them.
Well, I actually have a list.
I want like an arcade
I have a
kids,
list of the public
like,
one. Oh, that's a good idea. Also, a fake collection would also be great. An Arcane Kids style, like Sonic Dreams version.
That would be amazing.
Of all of the fake, they should just do. Someone should do a Valve game jam. That's like, oh, we're gonna finish all the games that you canceled. So I'm gonna read this list. There's a list of unreleased games over on Wikipedia. So you know, who knows? Maybe some of these are fake. But of all of the, I'll just read from the top. Several games announced by Valve as being in development have since been put on hold indefinitely. In addition, details on a number of unannounced projects from Valve have been revealed or leaked long after their cancellation. Prospero, a third-person exploration game with a science fantasy theme, the project was in development at the same time as Half-Life. Prospero's development team transitioned to work on Half-Life, which had gained more traction. Half-Life 2 Episode 3, announced in 2006 with a tentative release date of late 2007, the game was supposed to continue the story from Half-Life 2 Episode 2. Episode 3 missed its release date, and Valve has stopped discussing the project in the early 2010s. Half-Life 2 Episode 4, also known as Return to Ravenholm, this project was in development by Arcane Studios around 2006-2007. However, Valve decided not to take the project forward. In 2012, Valve writer Mark Laidlaw confirmed rumors surrounding the project's existence, and screenshots of gameplay later emerged in 2013. Untitled Half-Life 2 Episode. In November 2005, Junction Point Studios announced that it was working with Valve on a game. In April 2015, 10 years later, Junction Point's founder, Warren Spector, revealed the project was an episode for Half-Life 2. Development on the game ceased when Junction Point signed a deal with Disney Interactive to develop Epic Mickey. Oh. Blood's on your hands, Disney. Oh, make sure to watch Waypoint Presents on Disney XD every Wednesday. Untitled role-playing game, a fantasy action role-playing game about fairies that was in prototype phase and later canceled prior to Left 4 Dead release. The Crossing, a first-person shooter developed in collaboration with Arcane Studios.
Arcane again!
The project was announced in 2007 and put on hold in May 2009. That was that game that was going to be like single-player, multiplayer, like crossover thing.
Really interesting.
That was on magazine covers.
Yes, I have I can tell you what the Game Informer cover looks like. It was really beautiful, white, stark.
Game Informer, or was it Computer Gaming World? Maybe it was on covers of both.
Yeah, maybe.
It was going to change the world.
It was going to change the world. Yeah. The style in that game reminded me a little bit of like the secret world style.
Totally.
Of like sharp reds with like crosses. That game seemed like it was going to be good. Anyway, there's still more on this fucking list. Finally, Stars of Blood, which I'd never heard of until now. Stars of Blood, a space pirate game. In November 2012, Newell revealed the project's name and confirmed that it was no longer in development.
Oh.
I love that. That's like
that might have been a good call.
By the way, yeah, but like, I love that he came out to be like, oh, by the way, we're gonna make the space pirate game canceled. We canceled it. This sounds cool, right?
The same breath.
Yeah, exactly. All at once.
God.
Oh.
No, they just need to release like the orange casket. Where, like, all of this shit just, like, you know what? Like, there's some good levels in here. Just have at it.
Oh, my God.
That's the name. I got to write down.
That's the title of the episode. The Orange Casket by the Arcane Kids.
By the Arcane Kids. The Arcane Kids release. Also, the Arcane Kids. Yeah.
Yes. They have to spell it that way on the box.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
I love this.
Oh, my God.
And I hate it.
Video games.
Although the idea of one way that they could have sort of, like, done a pseudo apology for all this would actually be to have done, like, what if they put out like a 60-minute documentary that was like,
yeah,
yo, here's, we tried to make this game, here's how we failed,
that'd be so
and, like,
good.
Here are the concepts we explored, here's the ones we rejected, like that, like there were just so many ways to have done this that wasn't reading a paste bin of a potential ending to this game. Like, there are so many ways they could have brought this to a formal conclusion. And, like, this is something, like, because I'm so worked about it, I should probably just write about it at some point, but it's the lack of closure and their inability to capitalize on that, I think, gets at the dysfunction of them as a studio.
Instead of, just as Rob is pointing out, a company that is basically a rentier, right?
Like, well, and it's that lack of a public disclosure of just, like, just say who you are. Right? Like, own it. Like, I think people's annoyance is Valve's continued public image that they are something they clearly aren't, but then want to prop up. And you get Gabe Newell going out there saying, oh, we're working on 3 single-player VR games. Like, the fuck you are. Publish one and prove it.
Yeah. But, like, I want to be clear that there is something here. I do want to say that I think it is rad that they don't feel the need to publish anything. Like,
100%.
Like, that they should be able to, you know, they have the resources, and it's good, I think, practice to be able to say, okay, we're going to make non-commercial stuff, we're going to make stuff privately and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, we'll throw it out. But, like, also the degree of the lack of transparency here is what's so frustrating. And in general, the feeling that, like, you have all of these resources. This is what
all
it goes back to again.
All of this talent. This room,
all
you know?
Of and that games need leaders, right? Like, I, you know, Rob, part of what you said earlier was the reason that we forgive some of the, like, near monopoly on PC gaming that Steam has is this notion that they've given us a lot in terms of actual creative work, not just they've given us a lot in the sense that, like, all my games are in the same place, which is, like, kind of a bullshit argument because it's not that hard to run an EXE on your fucking computer. And I'm, like, even though my morals and my politics do not have necessarily a lot of wiggle room when it comes to things like monopolies and kind of putting economic pressure in order to crunch out creativity or in order to like, capitalize on lots of other people's labor, I do find an emotional tug that says, like, okay, but they put out – this goes back to the Taylor Swift conversation, right? Which is like, but if you put out a good fucking song, I'm going to look past your bullshit because I'm fucked up. Because, like, I'm not a perfect person, because if you release, like, Shake It Off or its follow-up, amazing
take it
sequel,
off.
Take It
yeah,
Off.
Take It
Half-Life
Off.
Half-Life 3, Episode 3.
Take It Off.
Take It Off.
Yeah, part of the Orange Casket. Exactly.
Right. I would be in a better position, or I would just find myself wanting to defend them. In the same way that I find myself wanting to defend other major companies that still put out really good work every now and then, right? Like, I think Nintendo does some shitty fucking things. Like, I legitimately do. I think that, like, their practices around fan creations is bad. I think that the stuff around the limited
Arcane
runs...
Arcane, even.
Right, they're even Arcane. The limited runs around things like the SNES Classic, the NES Classic, are bad. You know, and I hold them to that. But also, like, Breath of the Wild was incredible.
They make really, really great games.
I'm playing Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle right now. That game's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to put out a game of the year called Super Mario Odyssey in just, like, a couple of weeks.
If it's better than Prey. Which it might not be.
And Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, also a Nintendo joint.
Also Game
also
of the Year contender.
PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Put that on Switch.
Put that, oh, yo.
Oh my god, I could actually play it if it was on Switch. Like,
I think the Switch might overheat and the screen would crack.
God. I was playing something recently and I was mad that it wasn't on Switch. And
but also imagine if that game was
anything.
On Switch.
Right?
Yes!
Man... All right, we should talk about other things. Valve, like, get it together.
Yeah.
I wish we
lived in the world where they announced Half-Life 4, and then they also announced a two-hour, like, Half-Life 2, Episode 3 and Half-Life 3 movie, where they're like, all right, we have some creative ideas that have nothing to do with where that game ended. Like, here is what happened between that last Episode 2 and where we're going in Half-Life 4. And also maybe it's a VR thing, or maybe it's whatever it is. Just, like, make that next thing and just let us fill in the gaps however we need to. Do something.
God, just imagine.
If they did that, you could also inspire other developers to pick up some of those ideas. And we could actually play something that came out of that. Like, that would
dude, someone's going to do a fan mod that just adapts this anyway. And I cannot wait to play it.
That's what Emmanuel Myberg, who wrote it up over at Motherboard, was like, the nice thing about this is we're going to get that fan game 100%.
Yeah.
And
it's going to get sold on Steam.
Maybe that's okay.
It's going to be
it
sold
is.
On
Of course it is.
Steam.
Of course, because they set that up last year when they started allowing Half-Life mods to be sold on Steam. Mm-hmm. So let's zoom out one more level here before we leave this behind, which is it's not just they're not giving us single-player stuff anymore. That bums me out, right? Because if we'd gotten Left 4 Dead 3 and it was incredible and it pushed cooperative games forward the way that Left 4 Dead 2 seemed to, maybe I'd be in a happier place. But it's that they are doubling down. It's that games are changing and that niches are being introduced that are large enough to be sustainable, especially when it's tied to the world's largest gaming ecosystem and retail store. That, like... They didn't need to give me Half-Life 3 for me to be like a good like a fan of Valve. Like, I'm not a big Half-Life fan, as I already set up. But what I do want to do is be able to respect that they are innovating in places that touch gaming as a whole instead of touching these little smaller circles. Like, you know, we run stories about Dota not all the time, but pretty often, and I'm interested in them. Like, Josh Melnick wrote up about the changes in Dota in the last year of play, going from the last international to this international right before the international a couple weeks ago. And it was fascinating thinking about, oh wow, look at how this game's changed. Look at how they're like shifting the community and they're rebalancing things and they're, you know, supporting different styles of play and the variety of heroes that are played and blah blah blah. All of that's interesting, but you don't see that filtering out into the world of gaming the way like real-time physics simulation did. The way scripting in single-player action games from Half-Life 1 did. The way things like the AI director, obviously that was Turtle Rock originally, but even in as it was advanced in Left 4 Dead 2, the way that sort of thing has kind of drifted out along to the rest of the world of gaming. And like, that's where I want leaders in the world of gaming to be leaders. You have the resources to experiment and find new ways of solving problems and new ways of being creative. Figure those out. And then, like, you don't have to, like, go open source. I'm not asking you to, like, share the code.
Right.
But like, I want you to innovate in that space because, like, that's, for me, what a real leader looks like. It's one of the reasons why I think that small companies like From can be looked at as leaders in this industry, because they can shift the conversation around games and can start. We've all read that Matthew Burns – or played that Matthew Burns game of, like, what's that game called? The Writer's Room or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
The author will fix it.
The writer will fix it. Exactly. Where it's like, oh, try to make it more like Dark Souls. Try to make it more like Dark Souls. Like somehow From, which has a 100th of the resources that Valve does, managed to like completely change the direction of games in this industry in a way that then had a trickle-down effect to where roguelikes have had a renaissance, to where like, and that's what a company like Valve can do, and I'd like to see them do it again.
Hell yeah.
That's my appeal. Gabe, if you're listening.
Gabe.
Hey, Brendan, get on the phone with Gabe, will you? God, I know you have his number. All right. Shout outs to PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, the true Half-Life 3 sequel.
Hell yeah.
What if they release a PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds single-player mode, and it is The Crossing, and it is Half-Life 3?
Oh, my God.
And what if you...
Co-developed by Arkane.
I'm shocked Valve doesn't just buy Bluehole.
Yeah.
Well, Tencent beat him to the punch, right?
Oh, did Tencent buy them?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's there. Well, otherwise, we would be seeing Aperture Science graffiti instead of Gamescom graffiti. So, I mentioned Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle. We should talk about Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle, a new game from Nintendo and Ubisoft. That is,
you may remember it as the game that made a grown man, David Solani, I think is his name, cry at E3, and it was the most beautiful moment of E3. It was. I'm not being facetious. That was actually like. Beautiful.
Not a random really fan. Nice. He is the creative director of that game.
He's the creator of the game.
I love the notion. I'm just like, Danielle knows. There was one man.
There was a man in the audience.
No, it wasn't even on the... In my mind, it was just a guy walking through the floor
crying.
Of E3 and just like... David Solani just turns and looks and sees Mario shooting a rabbit with a blaster, a single tear, and then the floodgates open. He drops to his knees. Mario, he says, Mario.
Cool, I'm sure you like it.
A fucking like rabid peach like coming out of the sky, like Mufasa, and like reaching down.
I almost choked on my coffee, and I didn't know that was possible.
Oh my god! So yeah, it's Mario XCOM. Is the cheap? It's not. It's actually not in some important ways.
I think. Yeah, I've probably put in about 8 hours. I'm almost
okay.
Through the second world. There are five, barring a secret world, which wouldn't surprise me because that's a very familiar trope.
Yeah.
Nintendo themed games. I'd say like it's actually closer to like Mario or Fire Emblem than it is to XCOM. It has some of the aesthetic trappings of XCOM with like the percentages and the like Overwatch mechanic. For people that don't know, Overwatch is basically like when you've planted one of your squad mates, you can allow them to take a shot at someone as they like make a movement. It's a way of like getting like a second shot that's usually weaker than your primary shot, but you don't actually have to like reveal your position or something like that. Because this is more of a tactics are a part of this game, strategy is a part of this game, but it is a puzzle box that is wrapped in a tactics game, and that conceit is wrapped in a lot of meta layers. Like for example, when you finish an individual round, you are judged on your performance, and your performance is judged on keeping everyone alive and finishing under a certain amount of turns. And so you are encouraged, penalty-free, to restart a round if it goes poorly, and you want to try and achieve that perfect victory. You can, after the fact, go back to a specific chapter and try a battle when you're a little more powerful and have more options and can achieve that perfect gold medal that gets you more coins and power-ups. And so the game itself is structured in a way that you... Yeah, there are percentages, but like the percentages...
Well,
so you're never going to have
percentages, right?
Yes, there's 0, 50, and 100. You're never going to have an instance where you're going to be right next to. So, like, there's this, you know, the common XCOM trope of, let's say you're right around the corner from an enemy, or right in front of an enemy, and you have a 98% chance of making that shot, in which like the dice roll should almost always land in your favor. But famously, you're going to have at least once during like a 40-hour run an instance where you miss that shot. And it's infuriating
and
hilarious.
You. Yeah.
Yeah, and it screws everything up.
And the animation is hilarious because it's like the soldier lowers the shotgun to the sectoid's head and it's like cocks it and it's like, I got you, motherfucker. Pulls the trigger and just like lifts their arms up into the sky as if to shoot a warning shot or something.
And so that never happens. Like when you see a percentage, 50-50 is 50-50, 0 is 0, 100% is 100%. And so, like, you can make strategic calculations that you have a lot more reliability for, which is plays into the puzzle aspect of the game where it's encouraging you to be efficient, to work fast,
right,
to use skills that maximize. Like, this game has a huge focus on the squad mates interacting with one another. So
you can do thing where you, like, bounce off of one of your squad mates. Like, they'll toss you into the air, almost like a Power Ranger would. Chroma Squad, which came out like a couple years ago, which was like the Power Rangers tactical RPG by the people who did whatever that tabletop RPG. What the fuck was that called? Oh, it's going to kill me. Anyway, Chroma Squad did that same thing of just like, oh, you can jump from one of your characters to another character or like out into the world, which is really cool. What are some of the other like buffs and stuff like that in a way that there just aren't that often in XCOM?
Right, and the buffs start getting more interesting as the game progresses. Like, I just unlocked the sort of Rabid Mario. And so Rabid Mario is a tank class, basically. And so what Rabid Mario can do is he has this really interesting power that is 80% reduction of damage on movement. So essentially, like, when you get to the the first world of this game, I think some people, like, think of the whole first world as sort of a tutorializing of the basic mechanics, and you're going to wonder why, like, towards the end, like, how come these enemies can't use any of the powers that I have to make this encounter more complicated? That immediately switches in the second world, where they can start using buffs, they use a lot of the strategies that
they
you
use
have your
Overwatch
disposal.
Or something
they use
like
over,
it.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah, you will have three enemies that put themselves into Overwatch, and then the moment you, like, dash across the screen thinking, like, I'm going to bounce on two of my squad mates and make it a three-force across the map, which you could safely do otherwise, you can no longer do that because that means you're going to get hit three times and lose most, if not all, your health. But what this Mario Rabbit character can do is... He can, if you see a bunch of guys going to Overwatch, but you need to make a push forward, because, like, for example, there are certain types of encounters where you need to get Toad from one end to the map to the other. Toad can move, but he cannot attack. Toad cannot do any sort of, like, funny dash mechanics. He can't jump on other characters. He just needs to get from one other side to the other, and he doesn't have a lot of HP. So in that scenario, especially if you're going for the perfect run, you don't have time to dilly-dally. You can't just, like, crouch down and Overwatch and then just, like, slowly take everyone out. You have to keep moving forward. Like, the game is a lot about momentum and progression and continuing to move forward in an aggressive manner. And so what Mario Rabbit can do is that when those characters are going to Overwatch, like, he can buff up and then he can run out into the open, take all of those shots off the board, and because they're on a cooldown, you're going to have at least two or three turns where those characters are no longer going to go into Overwatch.
And that's when you can deal with them. And the other thing there, too, that's interesting is that, like, two things. One, this is just a funny game. Like, this is just a game that is goofy in a way that tactical RPGs tend not to be.
Correct.
Tactical RPGs are tense affairs because restarting is a big deal. You know, you look at something like XCOM where either you're going to... Even if your save's coming, it tends to be like you're deep into a match. Or not a match. You're deep into a mission before things go wrong. And you're like, ah, fuck.
all right, I'll redo the first, you know, 20 minutes of this mission again. Or you don't save scum and you lose somebody permanently. Also, the maps in XCOM are like procedurally generated, or I guess like XCOM 2, they're not. There's just a bunch of them, but there's a bunch of them and they're like randomly pulled from a hat. And so
it's
you like don't know.
It's kind of like Spelunky, right? So it's
XCOM
like
it's 1 was. I think XCOM 2, okay. I'm pretty sure I read, I could be completely wrong here, so fair warning. But XCOM 2, I think they just made a huge bucket of handmade levels. And
gotcha. Okay.
But it's a huge bucket, so you don't know, and you can't go back and repeat it. It's not like you're learning a map and you're learning the system. And so this has the space to be very goofy. This is the space to be to have a moment where someone, a rabbit in a luchador mask, bounces off of one of their friends to come jump down at me, and then Luigi, who was a sniper in this game, peeks around the corner of like a green cube, takes aim, and literally shoots the luchador rabbit out of the air with his vacuum cleaner sniper rifle. And like, wow. Yeah, okay. But the second thing is, it's also, you talk about momentum, Patrick. And one of the things that's really fascinating for me about this game, as someone who plays a lot of tactical RPGs, this game is about movement inside of a turn as this really fluid, circular, looping thing that you don't ever see in games like this. So on top of just being able to run around, you could do melee attacks where you kind of like run and do like a baseball slide into somebody, or like a slide tackle to do damage. Or you can have melee weapons too. Some like Mario gets a big hammer, blah, blah, blah. But when you do that run through melee attack, you don't end your turn. You get to keep moving. You can even go set up shop behind cover and take a shot. And then on top of that, there's the bouncing off of your allies thing. You're bouncing off the other members of your team. But also there are pipes throughout the levels, in the first world anyway, that let you like move up to higher levels or link into a different thing. And when you go through a pipe, you get extra movement, which means you can end up doing these things where you like are on the second level of looking down at a set of enemies. Run down, do a slide tackle through one of them, come back over, go through a pipe, go up to another level that's like across from where you used to be, and then loop back down and around through another pipe that brings you down and then back up to your original spot, get back into cover and take a shot. And so you end up doing these like really interesting circular loops through a level that feel like platforming in a very abstract sense, right?
Like, well, and you combine that with like a character like Mario, who specifically has an ability to, not all the characters can jump on another character to cause damage, but Mario, because, you know, known for jumping, like can do that. And so like think of it this way, like there's an additional layer of complexity to the loop you just described where like let's say he passes through a squad mate like on the way, like you can jump extra far like midway through that, jump off that character, land on an enemy that's below, get extra damage from the height differential, and then work his way into a pipe on the other side of the map where you can suddenly be like at the bottom of the map and the top of the map in a single turn, and still like set yourself up for an Overwatch or a shot. And it feels extremely fluid. And a lot of the mechanics as you unlock the skill tree, and the skill tree like unlocks about halfway through the first world. So if it feels like, if you're playing this game and it feels very basic up front, like no, the skill tree is not incredibly complex. It's three layers. And if you put in the effort to do some extra challenges and seek out the extra stuff, like you're probably going to be able to fill out most of that skill tree like about halfway through the game, unless there's like another skill tree that unlocks, but I doubt that's the case. You just end up having a lot of really interesting options where like Peach Rabbit can chain together dashes, so she can knock out three different people for not a lot of damage unless you invest points into it, but can do a lot of like quick punches, work her way back. And there's like other interesting layers on that. So like Rabid Luigi has something called Vampire. So when he knocks into, when he does a dash against an enemy, he inflicts them with this vampire status. And so at that point, it's not, he not only extracts damage based on the damage that he caused to a certain percentage when he does the dash, they're infected with that status for some amount of turns, and it impacts all the other players in your squad. So let's say, for example, you just took like a big hit from one of the larger enemies in the game. Well, like you can have Rabid Luigi inflict Vampire on that guy and then have everyone concentrate their fire, and all of a sudden they've just gotten a healing bonus despite the fact that you don't actually have a healer in your squad. Or the other interesting thing about like the tank Mario is that he has the ability to draw aggro. So like there are certain enemies that will aggro based on the fact that you're shooting them, but tank Mario can actually draw that aggro specifically based on an area of effect power. And so let's say you set up Mario and Luigi, who both have the ability to do these Overwatch, these like post-round shots. You can set them up, and let's say you have a specific enemy you need to draw out because they're about to take out one of your other squad mates, they're going after Toad. You can set them into Overwatch and then use Rabid Mario to draw them out. Right. It forces them to move. Like when you do the area of effect, that enemy is forced to move a certain amount of spaces, and then suddenly those. I used that last night in a scenario where I was Toad was about to take him out, and so I drew out this enemy. They both Mario and Luigi both take their shots, and then they're done. Like it's a game that as
and that's
I'm playing
on top
it,
of that's on top of. Elemental effects that a lot of the yep. weapons get, where you can set someone on fire, which can also pull them out of cover because they're on fire, and they do the Mario thing of like, "Oh, I'm on fire! I'm gonna run around!" Yep. So it's like screaming,
grab their butt, and
they
run.
Grab their butt, yeah, 100%, awesome. Or you know, a honey or glue or whatever that like locks them in place. So if you destroy cover, because when someone's behind cover and you miss, it hits the cover, and the cover can be destroyed depending on how powerful the attack is. Ooh. So there's all of these different interacting things. Rob, you need to play this game.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like I do.
As a tactics person, because of how different it feels from these other games while still feeling like fundamentally
it's,
like...
And it's extremely approachable, right? Like, yeah. So what I noticed last night when I was explaining the game to a buddy who's staying over for the weekend, who's really into games and was looking forward to this game, I had this moment when I was playing it where I was like, this game seems pretty simple. But then as I was explaining everything I was doing yeah. and all the things I was taking into account and all the options I had, I was like... Well, actually, part of the genius of this game is that it simplifies and makes approachable a bunch of dynamic interactions and options that I've just internalized. But then when I had to articulate all the things I was taking into account, I was like, holy shit, like there's a lot going on here. Now, granted, you could not interact with a lot of that stuff
right.
and just kind of just shoot and go into cover. And there's an easy mode that the game allows you to jump into at any time you start a round. It's not a difficulty slider for the whole game. It's a difficulty slider per round.
Yeah.
So if just like a particular round is giving you trouble, just drop into easy mode. Like, it's fine. There's no consequence. The game doesn't penalize you or anything like that. But it does the very Nintendo thing. And I think Breath of the Wild also does this really well. And it surprises me coming from someone like Ubisoft, where games like Assassin's Creed have yeah. a lot of systems but aren't very elegant about how those systems mish and mash, especially when you look at the UI of a game like Assassin's Creed Origins, you kind of just go like, ugh. This game mashes up in a very Nintendo Breath of the Wild way a bunch of really interesting, complex systems without overwhelming you, and often making those systems interact in a way that you're not even aware they're interacting. You're just processing and using them because they've onboarded you to it in a way that feels fluid and not overwhelming. I think it's a really damn good game. Like, I came yeah. away with positive impressions at E3, and I've put in, you know, if for folks that even find the initial or rounds not particularly challenging, there's an additional layer of challenges that open up per world. I think there's 10 each, and there's a hidden episode in those worlds that are like purposely more difficult because they're optional, and the challenges are like, for example, like it'll present like 8 enemies, like a selection of 3 that are pretty easy to take out, a selection of 4 that are like a little harder, and then like 1, you know, like a really difficult
Real
enemy
difficult.
And, it's a,
yeah.
and it says, hey, do this in 2 rounds, and it's like, oh fuck, like that you
oh,
then you
no,
need,
I
to,
need to stay away from that
then
oh.
you need to be think yeah then you need to be thinking like you have to think out all the interactions yep. you're going to be doing for the entire 2 rounds. And like, I was taking out like a notebook and thinking like, okay, like how are my hit points going to stack? Like,
oh, man.
And I was like, wow, like fuck. Like, so there is that extra layer of like really difficult, challenging, hardcore shit if you want to go there. And then that's what lets you like earn the extra stuff to like buy all the weapons that have the different elemental stuff that right. you may not be able to unlock through the normal set of coins they're getting you. Fill out the skill tree if you don't want to have to pick like all the different options that you would normally be presented with.
It's, I will
yeah.
say hmm. that aspect, the sort of puzzle solving aspect, hits me in different ways and different.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
times of the day. When I'm like on my bus into work and I have like, oh, I know I'm gonna have 40 minutes and I'm like, I'm waking up and I'm kind of like trying to find something to focus on. It's actually been really cool to be like, okay, what's the best way through this? Or like when I'm playing on a weekend, it's like, okay, I have a couple hours. I can really settle into that mode. But when I play tactics games, I'm often playing at night when I'm like a little sleepy. And I really enjoy kind of slamming my way through a mission and like getting a less than positive result. Because it doesn't matter. Like, when I play through XCOM, as long as my people are alive at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many missed shots I have. It doesn't matter if I took too many rounds, as long as I got the stuff, you know, as long as I managed to succeed at the mission. And I like that about a lot of tactical games, is, like, the messiness, the fact that it doesn't feel like there is a solution. I'm through the first world of Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle. I've only gotten perfect, so I'm not, like, bragging here, but I'm, like, saying it's not like this is too difficult for me. But I've gotten those at the expense of, like, stress in my day when I didn't want it, where I'm like, ah, fuck, okay, let me think about it. Let me actually try to solve for you know, for X instead of get into what feels like a good tactical line. And, like, there's a slightly different part of my, like, gaming brain between those
two
things.
Wait for World 2. Oh. Like, World 2 introduces... And if they're going to start scaling the game, like, right, at this pace for, like, World 2... Like, the fact that they introduce a tank character halfway through 2, right, and I still have, I think, 4 or 5 characters to unlock...
Oh, wow.
Like, makes me really excited for the potential of what those... Like, my guess is, like, the first 4 characters you unlock are pretty basic and, like, yeah, give you, like a general squad. But, like, you may not want to use, like, a tank character because that's going to be a little too complex or right, weird, or, like, require a level of thinking that maybe you just don't want to interact with the game like this, and you'd rather just, like, use the pistols and, like, the kind of, like, the basic setup. Uh-huh. But my hope is for, like, the other characters, they're going to be weird and they're going to, like, introduce, like, layers of tactical strategy and options for players that, like, hey, do you want to, like, do some weird shit when you, like, get into this match? Because I can't imagine the rest of the characters, or I'd be disappointed with the rest of the characters just being, like, here's another guy that uh-huh, does the same stuff that you've done. it's just a different Rabbit, or it's a different Mario character. Like,
right,
this game seems smart enough that I'm fairly confident those other characters are going to introduce dynamics that are going to make the rounds, like, really exciting and, yeah, and different.
It might even just be the case that it gets hard enough that I'm just like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to lose, so I'm not going to get a perfect. It's fine, I'll get through it. And once that happens, I'll be actually better with the game. But as long as I'm able to consistently get perfects with just a little bit of extra brain power, I'm going to be in this little middle area where it's like, this feels more like a puzzle than a combat to me, than a combat
encounter. I'll say World 2 is where I finally started losing characters. Okay. That, like, when I would lose a character in World 1, it was often because I just wasn't really paying attention.
Right.
I was like, ah, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done that. Whereas in World 2, like, I'd have to, like, really think through
right,
some of my stuff. And if it continues to scale in that way, that would make me really happy. I'm glad this game seems to be as good as I was hoping it yeah, was. And it's also, I think, the fear that Nintendo XCOM meant more simplified than the aesthetic possibly suggested. This feels more in line with, you know, maybe not as far as Fire Emblem, but somewhere in the middle. But also, I don't think it sacrifices complexity for the sake of simplicity,
right,
in a way that I think people might have been worried about. And the reason it reminds me of Fire Emblem is because when I play Fire Emblem with permadeath on, but I also don't allow anyone to die,
right.
Which is a very common way of playing yep, Fire Emblem. So it's like you embrace the fact that when a character goes down that you love, like, I'm not going to leave my boy Donald out there on the field. Like, he's coming home.
Right.
He's got to go home to that farm, have a family, raise those kids, like, make his dad proud, both his canonical in-game father and me, his video game father.
Yes.
And so when I have a character die in Fire Emblem, I start the match over and find right, a way for that not to happen. And so I'm treating it as a puzzle, but the puzzle is solved through tactics and strategy. And I'm getting the sense that Mario and Rabbids is similar, especially
yeah,
as the game progresses and increases complexity and difficulty.
The last one I'll compare it to is a game that came out last year, or maybe it was a year and a half ago now, called SteamWorld Heist.
I was going to ask about that, actually.
Yeah, it's
yeah,
actually very similar in, not very similar, but similar enough in that, like, it's about these smaller challenge, like, smaller combat encounters that are replayable, where it feels like there is a solution to some degree, but also there's enough complexity. There's not a solution. There are many solutions, and it's about, like, figuring out what that solution looks like given what your kind of like group of characters and abilities looks like. Also, people should play SteamWorld Heist. That game's like really fucking good. So that's my suggestion. I think that might do it for us today. We should maybe take a quick dip in the bucket, in the question, the old question bucket.
A little dipsy?
Yeah. Also, just briefly, I mentioned XCOM. I haven't played War of the Chosen, but I'm like so early in it still that I've only seen the very first little bits of what that expansion looks like, so I can't like say anything definitively on it. The way that 2K does press, like...
this
like,
is a new thing. This is...
It's so weird.
Yeah. It
I sucks. Did it for the first time last year. Have you used it before, Rob? Are you on the
No,
World
as I
Chosen?
Understand it, they're creating bespoke Steam accounts, though, right?
Yeah, for... I got a bespoke Steam account for XCOM War of the Chosen. They're like, oh, yeah, log in as, like, 2K underscore HQW 889 underscore XCOM or whatever with its own bespoke password and then its own separate... This is, like, some, like, games journalism wine bullshit right now. But, like, and then run a second, like... thing that verifies your IP address. And so I did that here at work because I was going to stream it. And then I went home to play the game. I was like, oh, fuck. It only lets you verify one IP address at a time. So now I have two different saves on two different accounts. I haven't checked yet to see if I can just transfer the save over or what, but...
It's like, it is a little bit of like, you know, game journalist whine, but at the same time, like, it's really freaking obnoxious. Like, you're using a platform like that's renowned for its convenience, so you can just like port a game from place to place. The other thing I want to say is, like, if you're having trouble with copies going out to the wrong people, or, you know, people not using it for the purposes they, you know, they're representing to your PR representatives, do your due diligence. You know what I mean? Yeah, but, like, that, right. But don't put that on, don't, like, do not come to professional, like, you know, game journalists and editors and then, you know, parcel it out like, well, now, are you really who you say you are? You can use this, but only in the office. Otherwise, it's play. And it's not going to be your game after the preview period ends. So if you're just in it for free games, you don't get to have one of those either. Like, it's really condescending, and it's a huge, like, pain in the ass. Like, we wanted to stream this week, but we couldn't. Because we didn't have access to the magic PC that, like, had this fucking build on it. Like, screw that.
It's a frustrating thing. But it's like, a very inside baseball thing. So I'm going to try not to complain about it too much. Instead, I'm going to go to the question bucket. I need a number between 1 and 53. Let's close this week out with a good one.
47.
Is that a good number?
It's a great number.
Why is that a good number?
It's a great number because 4 is a good number, 7 is a good number. Them together is like magic, baby. Yeah. I would have said 74, but, you know.
We're not there anymore. So. All right, here we go. This one comes in from Manuel from Guadalajara in Mexico.
Awesome.
Hello, Waypointers. Thanks for all the great work. Big fan of the site. I live in Mexico, and I work for an American company finding jobs for people in America and all over the world. In a global economy, my work generates jobs in the U.S. and plenty of other countries. Yet I have to put up with a lot of hate towards me personally and my country. Why do people see taking pride in Ford taking back their investment in my country and pointing and laughing at us when a tweet from the president elect from a while ago messes with our currency and our economy? Furthermore, if the behaviors of our number one trade partner is effectively affecting our economy, how come I'm constantly hearing that I should not have an opinion on American politics? Lack of knowledge of global economics work, lack of empathy, people just being assholes. I appreciate your insight. Thanks for all the great work. Big fan of the site. Manuel from Guadalajara. I think
all the above.
Yeah. I think there is a real lack of understanding what global economies look like. And I think that there is fair arguments to be made around global trade policy and stuff like that. But I think that's not where I think a lot of that comes from.
That's not where the MAGA stuff comes from.
Nah.
No. Well, that comes from no desire to learn about global policy, as well as not knowing a thing about global policy.
There's also an element of, like, a particularly intense disdain for Mexicans or people who can be confused with Mexicans in the United States. And I think part of that might be because, like, since the United States stole a good portion of its territory and absorbed a lot of people who were formerly Mexican into the United States, there is kind of this, like... there's this constant, like, surprise from, like, racists and bigots that, like, other people are here too.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, Mexicans, by our very, like, prevalence in American society and, like, prevalence in like, major population centers, kind of evoke that, like, nativist sentiment, that faux nativist sentiment of, like, what the hell are you people doing here? Couple that with the fact that, like, a lot of times Mexicans are associated with, like, service-level jobs that people feel entitled to treat people working those jobs as, like, lower class or lower status. And you've got a really toxic combination. The other thing I'll say is global capitalism is really good at getting people to blame the exploited for the actions of their exploiters.
Sure is.
Like, a lot of the NAFTA resentment is because, like, Mexicans took American manufacturing jobs. Well, that's sort of, it's not like they came in and, like, jacked all the jobs overnight and, like, dragged them down to Mexico. Like, trade laws changed and companies were suddenly entitled to, produce products in Mexico and bring them over to the United States very easily. And you could pay those Mexican workers considerably less and probably pay far less attention to workplace safety guidelines, workers' rights, HR regulations. And instead of critiquing that, instead of saying, like, hey,
the people who made those decisions are actually to blame for this.
Right. Yeah. And instead of saying, like, boy, it's pretty disgusting how, you know, major companies will go to, you know, very employer-friendly, worker-exploitative labor markets and then eliminate jobs in the United States. Instead of critiquing that, like, instead the conversation becomes about the people who are in the position where they have to take those jobs as if they had taken those jobs away from you personally.
Well, it's funny because we actually spent a lot of this week talking about the ways in which people focus on individuals who are part of a systemic labor problem instead of talking about what the systemic issues are, where those issues come from. Earlier this week, Polygon ran an excerpt of a book that's coming out. Do you remember what the name of the full book is? I forget what it is. It's by Walt Williams. The name of the book is Significant Zero, and they ran half of a chapter or something like that about I guess the title
that, of Crunch.
It's about Crunch. The title that Polygon gave it is Why I Worship Crunch, and they socialed it with like a brutally honest take on Crunch or a brutally honest look at Crunch, and it was basically this like deep like personal. Kind of anecdote about not even anecdote really, but like I guess just some thoughts about what the appeal of Crunch was to Walt, and kind of like how it was.
Should we say what Crunch is for?
I guess so.
Just in case.
Sure.
You probably read about video games. You've heard of this, but it basically refers to extremely, extremely intense long hours, usually towards the end of a project when you just got to get it done.
Right.
We're talking like 70, 80 plus hour weeks, you know, working all weekend long, and there's a lot of burnout from that, understandably. And it's sort of a process that it's very endemic. A lot of game companies sort of experience this. This was the sort of thing that, you know, EA spouse, that whole letter in the early 2000s was
totally brought. And so it was a piece that was just like, here's how I'm addicted to Crunch, or I spent some time addicted to Crunch. And it was just like, really, it ended up being this defense and legitimation of Crunch, even though it was supposed to be even though in context it may have been a takedown, as presented on their site, it was not. We ended up running a response to it from Cameron Kunzelman. Go to the site to look at that. And fundamentally, Cameron's point was, when we look at issues like Crunch, when we look at issues of labor exploitation, frankly, when we look at issues of racism and nationalism, we should be thinking systemically. We should be thinking about things in terms of their kind of root causes, their overdetermined causes, all the different things that combine to make something material in our independent lives, and we should be coloring those things with independent stories, with, you know, things that we confirm as being like, actually, this is what it looks like from the ground level. This is the lived experience. Exactly. And so from that perspective, Walt's piece is very useful of like, okay, hey, here is where someone could find themselves addicted to pushing themselves to the limit.
The intensity of that.
The intensity of it, the feeling of creative fulfillment, even if there isn't actually a lot of creative fulfillment happening. So trying to go to our site and look at that, and I think like that to me is also that like to just add on to Rob's thing about the kind of racism around Mexican labor, around international labor in general. I grew up in Atlantic City, and every summer a lot of Eastern European workers came into Atlantic City to work throughout all the retail shops, and just like every year I just heard like super shitty things said about people from Ukraine. Like, so, you know, that is that sort of thing follows from this elevation of, or partially the elevation of, individuals
as prime movers, as like, if you are affected by something, a lot of people will say it's because a single person or a group of individual people are doing this thing and not this larger thing, which is like they've been pushed into a position to do that, to take those actions because it's the only way that it makes sense in the market. I want to keep doing this conversation. Unfortunately, somebody else needs the space.
We're about to get kicked out,
which is fair. We knew when we had the space too. We went a little long today.
Can't say the price wasn't fair.
You can call me, maybe. Find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Where can people find you, Rob?
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
Danielle,
you can find me at Danielle RI, where I'm not dead.
Okay, that's good to know. Patrick had to step away for a moment. You can find him on Twitter at Patrick Klepek. You can find everything we do at waypointadvice.com, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, and youtube.com/waypointvice. That's going to do it for us. Thanks to Rob Schultz for doing the production for us today. We'll be back on Monday with more Waypoint Radio.
Yeah.
Until then, what do we say?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.